Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we share advances in treatment for EGFR mutated lung cancer, a brain-penetrant enzyme therapy for a rare pediatric disorder, and dual targeting of extramedullary myeloma. We review cardiogenic shock, work through a challenging diagnostic puzzle in a young woman with recurrent illness, and explore perspectives on corporatized care, vaccine policy, AI in medicine, and where clinicians carry grief. Sacituzumab tyromotecan in EGFR-TKI-resistant, EGFR-mutated, advanced, non-small cell lung cancer. By Wenfeng Fang from the Guangdong Provincial Clinical Research Center for Cancer, Guangzhou, China, and co-authors. Sacituzumab tyromotecan, SAC-TMT, is an antibody-drug conjugate targeting trophoblast cell surface antigen 2. This antigen is highly expressed in epidermal growth factor receptor, EGFR-mutated, non-small cell lung cancer, and is associated with resistance to EGFR TKIs. In this Phase 3 trial conducted in China, 376 patients with EGFR-mutated, locally advanced or metastatic non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer that had progressed after EGFR-TKI therapy were randomly assigned to receive SAC-TMT monotherapy or pemetrexed plus platinum-based chemotherapy. Among these patients, progression-free survival and overall survival outcomes were significantly better with SAC-TMT than with platinum-based chemotherapy. Treatment-related adverse events of grade 3 or higher occurred in 58% of patients receiving SAC-TMT and in 53.8% of those receiving chemotherapy, with the most common being a decreased neutrophil count. Treatment-related serious adverse events occurred in 9% and 17.6%, respectively. Survival with osimertinib plus chemotherapy in EGFR-mutated advanced NSCLC by Pasi Yane from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, and co-authors. The primary analysis of this trial showed that first-line treatment with osimertinib plus chemotherapy with a platinum-based agent and pemetrexed led to significantly longer progression-free survival than with osimertinib monotherapy among 557 patients with EGFR-mutated advanced non-small cell lung cancer. The current report provides results from the planned final analysis of overall survival. First-line treatment with osimertinib plus platinum pemetrexed led to significantly longer overall survival than osimertinib monotherapy, 47.5 months versus 37.6 months. Grade 3 or higher adverse events of any cause were reported in 70% of the patients in the osimertinib plus platinum pemetrexed group and in 34% of those in the osimertinib monotherapy group. Roy Herbst from the Yale Cancer Center, New Haven, Connecticut, writes in an editorial that the findings reported by Fang and co-authors in an exclusively Asian population suggest that SAC-TMT is a promising treatment option for patients with EGFR-mutated NSCLC after failure of EGFR-TKI therapy, potentially offering a new standard of care in this difficult-to-treat population. Confirmatory studies involving a Western population will most likely be needed for the treatment to receive approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. In the future, it is likely that TROP2 and other antibody-drug conjugates will be combined or administered sequentially with EGFR-TKIs for first-line treatment. In the report by Yane and co-authors, the results from the planned final analysis of overall survival showed that osimertinib plus platinum pemetrexed chemotherapy led to significantly longer median overall survival than osimertinib monotherapy. Although a median overall survival of nearly 4 years establishes this treatment as a new standard of care, whether patients are truly cured remains uncertain. Further studies are needed to understand whether the effect of combination therapy is additive or synergistic, and to determine the appropriate length of treatment. Given that the administration of platinum-based chemotherapy was limited to the first 12 weeks, and the administration of pemetrexed was continued only for a median of 8.3 months. The Phase 3 trial reports published in this issue describe new treatment options for patients with EGFR-mutated NSCLC. Nevertheless, the increased efficacy must be balanced against increased toxic effects, which indicates the need for better treatment selection. Only by integrating these insights can we design regimens that prolong survival and aim to cure. An intravenous brain-penetrant enzyme therapy for mucopolysaccharidosis II by Joseph Munzer from the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, Chapel Hill, and co-authors. Tivadenofusp alpha, comprising iduronate 2 sulfatase, fused to an engineered transferrin receptor-binding Fc domain, has been developed to treat neurologic and peripheral manifestations of mucopolysaccharidosis type 2, MPS 2, a rare lysosomal disorder causing progressive multisystem and neurologic decline. In this Phase 1-2 open-label study, 47 male participants up to 18 years of age with MPS 2 received weekly intravenous tivadenofusp alpha for 24 weeks, followed by an 80-week safety extension and a 157-week open-label extension. The primary objective was to evaluate the safety of tivadenofusp alpha. Common adverse events in participants treated with tivadenofusp alpha included infusion-related reactions, respiratory infection, pyrexia, and anemia. These events were clinically manageable with standard supportive care. Treatment over a median duration of 2 years appeared to reduce central nervous system and peripheral biomarkers of substrate accumulation and neuronal injury, with potential for improving clinical endpoints. In an editorial, Kan Ficicioglu from the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, writes that, for decades, delivery of enzyme replacement therapy across the blood-brain barrier has remained a major obstacle. Tivadenofusp alpha surmounts this barrier, representing a breakthrough for neuronopathic MPS2 and offering renewed optimism for affected families and clinicians. Caveats remain. Like all rare disease trials, the study is limited by its modest sample size, the heterogeneity of patients' ages and developmental stages, and the inherent challenges of assessing cognitive and adaptive function in young children with variable phenotypic severity. Although the observed benefit is promising, its durability will require longer-term validation, integration of real-world data, and ideally, randomized controlled trials. Tivadenofusp alpha offers systemic therapy to address both the neurologic and somatic facets of MPS2 on the basis of compelling biomarker and clinical evidence. The results of this study mark a critical turning point and bring the field one step closer to the elusive goal of comprehensive disease modification. Collaboration among clinicians, families, regulators, and industry will be essential as we enter a new age in the treatment of MPS2 and related lysosomal storage disorders. Dual targeting of extramedullary myeloma with talquetamab and teclistamab by Shaji Kumar from the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota, and co-authors. Patients with plasmacytomas that are non-contiguous with bone marrow, true extramedullary myeloma, are at high risk for disease progression or relapse. Phase 1 of this study showed promising efficacy with dual antigen targeting of myeloma with talquetamab plus teclistamab in patients with triple class exposed, relapse or refractory multiple myeloma, including those with true extramedullary myeloma. Phase 2 of this study investigated talquetamab plus teclistamab exclusively in 90 patients with drug-resistant true extramedullary myeloma. Talquetamab plus teclistamab led to an overall response of 79%. 54% of the patients had a complete response or better, and 64% of the patients with a response had a response duration of at least 12 months. The incidence of adverse events of grade 3 or above was high and was consistent with previous observations for each agent as monotherapy. Cardiogenic shock, a review article by Holger Thiele from the Heart Center Leipzig at Leipzig University, Germany, and Christian Hassayer from the University of Copenhagen, Denmark. Cardiogenic shock is characterized by depression of cardiac function that leads to low blood pressure, coronary ischemia, and further decreased cardiac contractility, resulting in tissue hypoxemia. The condition is associated with high early mortality, approaching 50%, which is largely influenced by the underlying etiologic factors. In infarct-related cardiogenic shock, rapid restoration of coronary blood flow substantially reduces mortality. Mechanical circulatory support devices offer hemodynamic stabilization and improved outcomes in carefully selected patients, although optimal patient selection and timing of initiation of mechanical circulatory support remain areas of active investigation. While there have been advances in coronary revascularization techniques and mechanical circulatory support devices, overall survival in cardiogenic shock has only improved modestly. Therefore, future research should focus on refining treatment algorithms, optimizing device use, and developing new strategies to address the high mortality associated with cardiogenic shock. Closing the Gap, a clinical problem-solving article by Colin McLeish from Johns Hopkins Hospital, Baltimore, and co-authors. A 31-year-old woman presented after 10 days of fever, sinus pressure, cough, nausea, and vomiting. In the previous 5 months, 3 episodes of similar symptoms, as well as night sweats, fatigue, and weight loss, had occurred. Her medical history included childhood immune thrombocytopenia. Examination revealed cervical lymphadenopathy and hepatosplenomegaly. Laboratory results showed pancytopenia, transaminitis, and a low gamma gap, suggesting hypogammaglobulinemia. Imaging revealed lymphadenopathy and pulmonary, hepatic, and gastrointestinal granulomas. Extensive infectious and oncologic testing, including cultures and biopsies, was negative. Immunoglobulin levels were low, and her response to pneumococcal vaccination was impaired. Flow cytometry showed B-cell lymphopenia and diminished memory B-cells. With no secondary cause identified, her symptoms, findings, and laboratory results led to a diagnosis of common variable immunodeficiency, CVID, a primary immunodeficiency characterized by hypogammaglobulinemia, poor vaccine response, and a range of infectious, autoimmune, and inflammatory complications. From patients to consumers. The Corporatization of Ambulatory Care, a perspective by Ambar LaForgia from the University of California, Berkeley. The core principles of retail business, convenience, customer service, and efficiency, are becoming increasingly pervasive in U.S. healthcare. The retail model is especially evident in ambulatory care, which encompasses services that are delivered outside hospital walls, in settings ranging from walk-in retail clinics to specialized office-based medical practices. Attracted in part by profitable outpatient services and consumer demand for convenient care, a diverse set of corporate entities, including retail chains such as CVS, big tech companies such as Amazon, and financial investors such as private equity firms, have expanded into U.S. ambulatory care. Corporate owners could bring the managerial expertise, operational efficiency, and capital needed to expand access to healthcare and enhance patient experience. But many people find the idea of running healthcare like a retail business unsettling, and for good reason. Unlike simple retail transactions, clinical encounters are defined by uncertain outcomes and asymmetry of information, and the maxim that the customer is always right can directly conflict with clinical judgment. Although convenience is valuable, more research is needed to understand the broader effects of corporatization on patients and clinicians. A threat to evidence-based vaccine policy and public health security at the FDA. A perspective by Robert Califf from Duke University School of Medicine, Durham, North Carolina, and co-authors. These authors, all former commissioners of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, who collectively guided the agency's oversight for over 35 years through myriad public health crises, are deeply concerned by the sweeping new FDA assertions about vaccine safety and proposals that would undermine a regulatory model designed to ensure that vaccines are safe, effective, and available when the public needs them most. A memo sent last week to FDA staff will upend core policies governing vaccine development and updates. These measures and the unilateral way they are being imposed undermine the public interest. The memo characterizes the actions of FDA scientists who express concerns about agency processes or decisions to outside parties as, quote, unethical and illegal. It calls for scientific debates to be kept within the agency, quote, until they are ready to be made public, and instructs staff members who disagree with the new framework to, quote, submit their resignation letters. The proposed guidelines reject immunobridging studies, stating that, quote, no amount of immune surrogates can justify vaccine updates, a shift that would impede the ability to update vaccines, suppress innovation and competition, and require pre-marketing randomized clinical trials for most new products. The new approach would also evade public transparency by foregoing advisory committees, despite their purpose of enabling independent expert review in public. These authors argue that instead of stifling argument and oversight, the FDA must preserve open deliberation, solid evidence, and procedures the public can see and trust. Statistics in medicine. What's in an estimand? A perspective by Andrea Troxell from New York University and co-authors. Randomized clinical trials provide the foundation for inferring the causal effects of an intervention or policy on a particular endpoint. For example, when study participants are randomly assigned to receive either a drug or a placebo, any between-group difference in the endpoint should be solely attributable to the group assignment, because other factors that could influence the endpoint should be balanced between groups, and thus treatment effects should be estimated from the sample of all participants assigned to a group, irrespective of adherence to their assigned treatment. However, recently, articles on GLP-1 receptor agonists, as an example, have presented as part of secondary analyses an effect estimate that may be unfamiliar to some journal readers. The trial product estimand, also called an efficacy estimand. The term estimand is a precise definition of a treatment effect reflecting a clinical question related to a given clinical trial objective, including the strategy for handling intercurrent events. The intention to treat ITT estimand quantifies the causal effect of treatment assignment and is often described as the real-world effect. In contrast, recent GLP-1 receptor agonist trials have reported a secondary trial product estimand based on a hypothetical strategy that imagines a scenario in which treatment discontinuation wouldn't occur. In GLP-1 trials, where some participants stop following the medication regimen because of side effects or lack of weight loss, this approach discards post-discontinuation data and imputes values as if treatment had continued. Because people who continue receiving treatment are more likely to be benefiting from it, these imputations inflate the treatment effect relative to the ITT estimate. In actuality, however, the hypothetical trial product effect hasn't been and probably couldn't be observed and might be erroneously interpreted as a realistic treatment effect. The prospective authors call for more clarity and transparency in reporting results in GLP-1 and in all clinical trials. Where do I put this? A perspective by Danielle Shamas from the University of California, San Francisco. In a PTA meeting, Dr. Shamas was struggling to be present in a discussion of whether making crafts out of recycled materials or planting sunflower seedlings in egg crates would be a superior Earth Day activity. The day before, she had witnessed a body's final rattled, gasping breath to a spirit's beautiful, spunky, laughing light becoming stillness. Surely, a 75-year-old woman whom Dr. Shamas had come to know well over years as her outpatient palliative care doctor had invited Dr. Shamas to be present for her death. The next day, as Dr. Shamas sat in the PTA meeting, she couldn't shake the image of Shirley in her final hour, willing her weakened body to thrust her hand in the air as she sang the "Lie, Lie, Lie" of Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer. It had inspired the roomful of loved ones to joyfully throw up their hands too, as if for a moment they were sitting around a campfire celebrating, rather than marking a day of death. Dr. Shamas had at first felt nervous before crossing the threshold of Shirley's home, but they quickly fell into their familiar rhythm when, right after making introductions, Shirley urged Dr. Shamas to feel the impressively soft bamboo material of her pajamas. Then, in the PTA meeting, Dr. Shamas's opinion was requested. Giant sunflower seeds or regular? Dr. Shamas cared. She promises that she cared. She was part of the PTA because she finds what they do meaningful. Yet honoring the private sacred space she was invited into the day before was of utmost importance to Dr. Shamas, and she was questioning whether there was some betrayal in her casually moving on to seedling varieties and egg crate pots. She supposed on some level her struggle was simple. She was grieving the loss of a person she cared about deeply, and she had nowhere to put that grief within the structure of her current reality. But she also knew that, just as the seed deserves its egg crate nest of soil, this loss, too, deserved a place. Lie, lie, lie. In our images in clinical medicine, a 17-day-old boy was referred to a specialty clinic for evaluation of suspected osteogenesis imperfecta. Serial x-rays of the spine showed the development of vertebral compressions by 3.5 months of age. In cases of severe osteogenesis imperfecta, vertebral compressions may occur in infants before the development of the gravitational stress of sitting or standing. In another image, a 6-month-old boy was referred in 2017 to a pediatric neurology clinic in Brazil for evaluation of developmental delay. CT of the head at 1 month of age had shown lissencephaly and intracranial calcifications. At the beginning of the second trimester, which was during the 2015-16 Zika virus epidemic, the baby's mother had had a rash and had tested positive for Zika virus. A diagnosis of probable congenital Zika syndrome was made. In a third image, an 80-year-old man presented in August with a 4-day history of a rash on his abdomen. 5 days earlier, the patient had been working in his garden. Skin redness had first developed around his umbilicus and then had gradually spread outward. On physical examination, a small gray protrusion was noted in the umbilicus. With the use of surgical forceps, the protrusion was grasped securely at its attachment site at the base of the umbilicus and extracted, revealing an engorged adult female tick. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.